This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents Blood Rites, The Origins and History of the Passions of War. Written by Barbara Ehrenreich. Read by Amy Landon. Forward. Some years ago, I had occasion to need a theory of war. The occasion, fortunately, was only a literary one. I had been asked to write the preface to the English translation of a book about the 20th century German warrior elite, Klaus Thewelite's Fascinating Male Fantasies. I was flattered to be asked, but felt inadequate to the task. After all, my only qualification was that I had written a book about men and masculinity, the hearts of men. And nothing in that had touched on the subject of war. I soon found that there are no theories of war, or, depending on what you are willing to accept as a theory, far too many of them. Ask a scholar for an explanation of war, and he or she will most likely snicker at your naivete in expecting that something so large and poorly defined could even be explained. Ask a non-specialist, however, and you will get any of a dozen explanations, each proffered with utter confidence. It is because of our innate aggressiveness, or because of innate male aggressiveness, or because of imperialism and greed, or overpopulation and a shortage of resources, or manipulation by evil, bloody-minded elites. Or it is simply a manifestation of unknowable evil. Our understanding of war, it occurred to me, is about as confused and unformed as theories of disease were roughly 200 years ago. At that time, there was no consensus among men of science as to whether disease arose from sources within the afflicted individual, such as ill humors and bad habits, or whether its source lay in something outside us, in the night air, for example, or dangerous miasmas. Among the public at large, sin, which played the same role in early theories of disease as innate aggressiveness plays in those of war, remained a popular explanation. None of this would be cleared up until the middle of the 19th century, when the discovery of a heretofore invisible and unsuspected agent of disease, germs, would open the way to seeing all diseases as biological afflictions, traceable to molecular and cellular events. Though, of course, embedded in the social ecology of cities and classes and migrations and conquests. In one way, our prospects of understanding war are far bleaker than the prospects of understanding disease were 2 centuries ago. At least at that time, the period of enlightenment in Western thought, educated people were convinced that a theory was discoverable and well worth the effort of seeking. Today, there is no such self-confidence among the people most entitled to possess it. The social scientists to whom one might naturally turn for some understanding of an institution like war have, in all too many cases, given up on big questions and sweeping theories of any sort, and are engaged instead in narrow empirical studies, or, what is safer yet, critiques of studies already done. But the silence of the academics can only frustrate the curious layperson. There is something in us, or at least something in some of us, that urgently seeks to make sense out of disconnected data and unassimilated experience, to draw links between people like us and people not at all like us, between what happened long ago and what is happening right now, or could happen next. The urgency increases when the subject at hand, like war or disease, involves life and death, including the potential death of all people on Earth. We need to know, and we need to know something more than piles of unrelated observations. So the reckless amateur rushes in where the prudent scholar fears to tread. 11 years ago, prodded by the assignment of a 2,000-word preface to a book unknown in my own country, I began my study of war. Unrestrained by loyalty to any particular academic discipline, I read widely, and at first almost randomly, puzzling over ethnographic and historical detail, savoring the sweeping perspectives of those few who dared to propose them. Being a journalist, as well as an amateur scholar, I not only read people's books and articles, but also tracked down the authors at their homes or offices and pestered them with my questions. I shamelessly borrowed from my children's higher educations, studying over their shoulders, as it were, anthropology at Oxford and religious studies at Brown. I gave talks which were initially mostly questions and left with new insights and long lists of suggested readings. In keeping with my original preoccupations, as well as with Tavelite's theme, my suspicions first centered on the theme of gender. Wars, after all, have been fought, in almost all cases, by men, and sometimes for the stated purpose of making them men. But as I pressed back further in time and broadened my inquiry to include other forms of organized and socially sanctioned violence, such as rituals of blood sacrifice, a deeper and far more ancient explanatory theme emerged. This was not something I had ever thought about before. In fact, it lay entirely outside my conceptual framework and analytic approach to the world. What it amounts to is a new evolutionary perspective on war and related forms of violence. But, if I am right about the direction in which the relevant scholarship is tending, one that will not remain new and startling for long. This is a theory about the feelings people invest in war and often express as their motivations for fighting, where these feelings might have originated, and how they have played out in history. I should emphasize at the outset that human feelings do not account for all that we might want to know about war or particular wars, why they start in each instance, or end in the ways that they do. On the question of what causes war or any particular war, Tolstoy still has the last word. The deeper we delve in search of these causes, the more of them we discover, and each single cause or series of causes appears to us equally valid in itself and equally false by its insignificance compared to the magnitude of the event. It was a long time before I was able to make this distinction. That is, to understand that the feelings we bring to war are not, in themselves, a full and complete explanation for the persistence of war. What war is, why it really happens, and what we might do to keep it from happening are questions we will return to in the second half of this book, and especially at the very end. Until then, the focus will be on the feelings we bring to war, with the understanding that they are not the sole cause of war. They are the way it digs its talons into us, no more than that, and no less. A note of caution. The standards of proof in an endeavor like this are hardly as firm as those that prevail in the natural sciences, which constituted my formal education. Speculation plays a definite role here, though I will try to alert you to where it begins and leaves off. But the occasional foray into speculation does not mean that we can be content with any old story which suits our tastes and fits a smattering of the data. I have done my best here to make sense of certain recurrent and disturbing patterns of human behavior. If the result fails the test of careful scrutiny or future findings, others will have to do better. Introduction. 3 decades have passed, almost to the day, since an obscure government intellectual declared that the end of the Cold War brought with it the end of history. Who could not feel relief? The wars of that bloodiest of centuries had killed more than 100 million people. 2 years after the pronouncement, American pilots and tank commanders were killing tens of thousands of Iraqis in the Gulf War, And with decidedly less fanfare, genocide was creeping back into Europe, as the first of more than 100,000 Muslims, Croats, and Serbs died at the hands of their neighbors in the Balkans. 3 years later, by now the Bosnian genocide was blazing on under the eyes of an international television audience, complete with footage from inside concentration camps. Thousands of Rwandan Hutus took up machetes and, in fewer than 90 days, murdered 700,000 of their Tutsi neighbors. After the killing had mostly run its course in the Balkans, the United States, in belated support of the New World Order its president had proclaimed in 1991, sent bombers to help put an end to the conflict, killing thousands from the air, and sent them back again 4 years later to snuff out another war in Kosovo, killing thousands more. 3 years after that, 19 young men from the Middle East, armed with box cutters, managed to hijack several airliners and drove them into buildings in New York and Washington, killing nearly 3,000 people, and leading the United States to launch its global war on terror. Young Americans were sent to invade Afghanistan and Iraq. Thousands of troops and hundreds of thousands of civilians died. And out of these conflicts arose not only the phantasmagorically bloody Islamic State, but a series of forever wars that the United States is still fighting, sending unmanned drones and special operations commandos into a half dozen countries across the Middle East, South Asia, and the Horn of Africa. That's a lot of history, and a lot of blood. Sometimes it seems, especially to this sometime war correspondent, the two are indistinguishable. Stalin saw cruelty as the cutting edge of history. I, admittedly, with less experience than he had, am inclined to say it is blood. Plainly, to human beings, nothing is more compelling than the violent shedding of blood. If it bleeds, it leads, so we say, and have ever said in the news business. In our popular entertainment, movies, books, graphic novels, games, bloody conflict leads as well. As a species, we spill blood, and as a species, we are transfixed by its spilling. Nothing more reliably fascinates us. Nor does this fact, when acknowledged, cease to make us uncomfortable. After all, isn't there something disturbed about it? Morbid. Inhuman, at the least. Writing 25 centuries ago, Plato made the point vividly in The Republic, 4. Leontius, the son of Aglaion, was going up from the Piraeus under the outside of the north wall when he noticed corpses lying by the public executioner. He desired to look, but at the same time he was disgusted and made himself turn away, and for a while he struggled and covered his face. But finally, overpowered by the desire, he opened his eyes wide, ran toward the corpses, and said, "Look, you damned wretches, take your fill of the fair sight." Confronted with the dead, Leontius was overpowered by the desire. But for what? With this desire, I am deeply familiar. To become a war correspondent is to turn Leontius's shameful desire into a livelihood. I was not yet 30 when I stood in the slum in Port-au-Prince, scribbling in my notebook as I watched a shouting crowd of Haitians dismember with machetes an intruder they thought threatened the neighborhood. And I followed them eagerly as they promenaded with the bloody parts above their heads. I had notebook in hand as I watched Bosnian men heave mutilated corpses into the back of an old dump truck in a marketplace in Sarajevo, where a mortar shell had eviscerated a crowd of shoppers, many of whom I had been interviewing moments before. As I moved to get a better look and count the arms and legs, 68 people had been killed. I slipped and staggered forward into the truck bed. My boots had been treading through a veritable lake of blood. Like Leontius, I found myself pushing my body forward toward the corpses, and like him, my disgust had been far overwhelmed by my desire. The fascination and the exultation of killing is one of the realities of human nature, and, in its embodiment as war, perhaps the preeminent driver of human history. The question why is so large and all-encompassing that we rarely even see it posed as a question. It is simply the disquieting truth. Barbara Ehrenreich has not only dared to pose the question, but with a boldness and clarity typical of her remarkable work, she has proposed a daring answer. It is a compelling and, again, typically, disturbing one. Blood Rights disturbed me when I first read it 20 years ago, and as I turned the final page a moment ago, I found myself disturbed all over again. Her arguments are complex and imaginative and daring, and she builds them painstakingly with the help of paleontologists, anthropologists, and other scholars harder to classify. Where evidence is scarce, she lets her instincts guide her. Watching this masterful creative inquiry unfold gives much pleasure and makes the book a vivid and gripping read. Ehrenreich digs and digs until she confronts something very deeply embedded in us and proposes that this something has been lurking there since a great turning point in the lives of our most ancient ancestors. It was a grand triumph, perhaps the grandest in the human story, when we at last matched in ferocity and cleverness those who were killing us, and began to kill them. Our victory over the other animals was a brilliant achievement, but clearly, it took its toll. The kindest thing one can conclude about the long record of human carnage is that it may have been only through the compulsive repetition of acts and spectacles of violence, the hunt, the sacrifice, the initiatory ordeal, and eventually the war, that our ancestors were able to reassure themselves that they were, in fact, no longer prey. The killed had become the killers. And in order to ward off the ancient history of fear and anxiety that was the life of prey, they found themselves compelled to reenact that triumph, to kill, and to keep killing. This, of course, is not even the barest of summaries. Ehrenreich's argument is richly braided and provocative. It compels the reader to direct a penetrating look within, and to consider what exactly it is, if anything, that makes us human. Blood Rights gains its force not only from its explanatory power, but, for this reader at least, its unflinching confrontation with what is ugly in us. You feel upon you a most direct gaze, as if the author knows something secret about you and is determined to reveal and explain it. This feeling of being targeted in your very humanness makes the book uniquely compelling. Is she right? One must begin by saluting the quest. It is exhilarating to meet headlong such large facts of history and prehistory and demand they yield their secrets. The demands are supported by a skill and craftsmanship that is inspiring. As for Ehrenreich's provocative answer, it is not and will never be the kind that can be proved and settled. But one gains from her book, and this is perhaps its unique power, the uncanny sense of being somehow understood. The feeling is not at all a comfortable one, like dreaming of finding oneself suddenly naked upon a stage. The hope is that we can learn from it, and perhaps begin to confront the animal in us, and the guilty pleasures that animal feels compelled to enjoy. Such a confrontation, if it comes, will take a very long time. As I write, American drones are buzzing above Afghanistan and Iraq and Yemen and Somalia, from time to time incinerating human beings. A gaggle of militants here, a party of wedding guests there, with their bolts from the sky. For us humans of the third millennium, war has become daily war, constant war, forever war. The blood rites are mechanized, institutionalized, bureaucratized. As long as they go on, the end of history will remain a kind of self-flattering collective delusion, letting us keep our eyes focused on lofty points ever distant from who we really are. Mark Danner, Grizzly Peak, Berkeley, California, August 2019. Mark Danner has covered war and political conflict for 3 decades, writing about Central America, Haiti, the Balkans, and Iraq, among other stories. He is the author of The Massacre at El Mazote, Torture and Truth, Stripping Bare the Body, Politics, Violence, War, and, most recently, Spiral, Trapped in the Forever War. Part 1. Predation. 1. The Ecstasy of War. So elemental is the human need to endow the shedding of blood with some great and even sublime significance that it renders the intellect almost entirely helpless. Martin von Krefeld. Different wars have led to different theories of why men fight them. The Napoleonic Wars, which bore along with them the rationalist spirit of the French Revolution, inspired the Prussian officer Karl von Clausewitz to propose that war itself is an entirely rational undertaking, unsullied by human emotion. War, in his famous aphorism, is merely a continuation of policy by other means, with policy itself supposedly resulting from the same kind of clear-headed deliberation one might apply to a game of chess. Nation-states were the leading actors on the stage of history, and war was simply one of the many ways they advanced their interests against those of other nation-states. If you could accept the existence of this new super-person, the nation, a battle was no more disturbing and irrational than, say, a difficult trade negotiation, except perhaps to those who lay dying on the battlefield. World War I, coming a century after Napoleon's sweep through Europe and Northern Africa, led to an opposite assessment of the human impulse to war. World War I was hard to construe as in any way rational, especially to that generation of European intellectuals, including Sigmund Freud, who survived, to ponder the unprecedented harvest of dead bodies. History textbooks tell us that the Great War grew out of the conflict between competing imperialist states. But this Clausewitzian interpretation has little to do with the actual series of accidents, blunders, and miscommunications that impelled the nations of Europe to war in the summer of 1914. At first swept up in the excitement of the war, unable for weeks to work or think of anything else, Freud was eventually led to conclude that there is some dark flaw in the human psyche, a perverse desire to destroy, countering eros and the will to live. So these are, in crude summary, the theories of war which modern wars have left us with. That war is a means, however risky, by which men seek to advance their collective interests and improve their lives. Or, alternatively, that war stems from sub-rational drives not unlike those that lead individuals to commit violent crimes. In our own time, most people seem to hold both views at once, avowing that war is a gainful enterprise intended to meet the material needs of the groups engaged in it, and, at the same time, that it fulfills deep and irrational psychological needs. There is no question about the first part of this proposition, that wars are designed, at least ostensibly, to secure necessaries like land or oil or geopolitical advantage. The mystery lies in the peculiar psychological grip war exerts on us. In the 1960s and 70s, the debate on the psychology of war centered on the notion of an aggressive instinct, peculiar to all humans or only to human males. This is not the place to summarize that debate, with its endless examples of animal behavior and clashes over their applicability to human affairs. Here, I would simply point out that whether or not there is an aggressive instinct, there are reasons to reject it as the major wellspring of war. Although it is true that aggressive impulses, up to and including murderous rage, can easily take over in the heat of actual battle, even this statement must be qualified to take account of different weaponry and modes of fighting. Hand-to-hand combat may indeed call forth and even require the emotions of rage and aggression, if only to mobilize the body for bursts of muscular activity. In the case of action-at-a-distance weapons, however, like guns and bows and arrows, emotionality of any sort can be a distinct disadvantage. Coolness and the ability to keep aiming and firing steadfastly in the face of enemy fire prevails. Hence, according to the distinguished American military historian Robert L. O'Connell, the change in the ideal warrior personality wrought by the advent of guns in the 15th and 16th centuries from ferocious aggressiveness to passive disdain. So there is no personality type, hot-tempered, macho, or whatever, consistently and universally associated with warfare. Furthermore, fighting itself is only one component of the enterprise we know as war. Wars are not barroom brawls writ large, or domestic violence that has been somehow extended to strangers. In war, fighting takes place within battles, along with much anxious waiting, of course. But wars do not begin with battles and are often not decided by them either. Most of war consists of preparation for battle, training, the organization of supplies, marching and other forms of transport, activities which are hard to account for by innate promptings of any kind. There is no plausible instinct, for example, that impels a man to leave his home, cut his hair short, and drill for hours in tight formation. As anthropologists Clifton B. Kroeber and Bernard L. Fontana point out, it is a large step from what may be biologically innate leanings toward individual aggression to ritualized, socially sanctioned, institutionalized group warfare. War, in other words, is too complex and collective an activity to be accounted for by a single warlike instinct lurking within the individual psyche. Instinct may, or may not, inspire a man to bayonet the first enemy he encounters in battle. But instinct does not mobilize supply lines, manufacture rifles, issue uniforms, or move an army of thousands from point A on the map to B. These are complicated, orchestrated, highly organized activities, as social theorist Robin Fox writes, undertaken not by individuals, but by entities on the scale of nations and dynasties. The hypothesis of a killer instinct, according to a commentator summarizing a recent conference on the anthropology of war, is not so much wrong as irrelevant. In fact, throughout history, individual men have gone to near-suicidal lengths to avoid participating in wars, a fact that proponents of a warlike instinct tend to slight. Men have fled their homelands, served lengthy prison terms, hacked off limbs, shot off feet or index fingers, feigned illness or insanity, or, if they could afford to, paid surrogates to fight in their stead. Some draw their teeth, some blind themselves, and others maim themselves on their way to us. The governor of Egypt complained of his peasant recruits in the early 19th century. So unreliable was the rank and file of the 18th century Prussian army that military manuals forbade camping near a woods or forest. The troops would simply melt away into the trees. Proponents of a warlike instinct must also reckon with the fact that even when men have been assembled, willingly or unwillingly, for the purpose of war, fighting is not something that seems to come naturally to them. In fact, surprisingly, even in the thick of battle, few men can bring themselves to shoot directly at individual enemies. The difference between an ordinary man or boy and a reliable killer, as any drill sergeant could attest, is profound. A transformation is required. The man or boy leaves his former self behind and becomes something entirely different, perhaps even taking a new name. In small-scale, traditional societies, the change was usually accomplished through ritual drumming, dancing, fasting, and sexual abstinence, all of which served to lift a man out of his mundane existence and into a new, warrior-like mode of being, denoted by special body paint, masks, and headdresses. As if to emphasize the discontinuity between the warrior and the ordinary human being, many cultures require the would-be fighting man to leave his humanness behind and assume a new form as an animal. The young Scandinavian had to become a bear before he could become an elite warrior, going berserk. The word means dressed in a bear hide, biting and chasing people. The Irish hero Cuchulainn transformed himself into a monster in preparation for battle. He became horrible, many-shaped, strange and unrecognizable, with one eye sucked into his skull and the other popping out of the side of the face. Apparently, this transformation was a familiar and meaningful one, because similarly distorted faces turn up frequently in Celtic art. Often the transformation is helped along with drugs or social pressure of various kinds. Tahitian warriors were browbeaten into fighting by functionaries called rauti, or exhorters, who ran around the battlefield urging their comrades to mimic the devouring wild dog. The ancient Greek hoplites drank enough wine, apparently, to be quite tipsy when they went into battle. Aztecs drank pulque. Chinese troops at the time of Sun Tzu got into the mood by drinking wine and watching gyrating sword dancers perform. Almost any drug or intoxicant has served, in one setting or another, to facilitate the transformation of man into warrior. Yanomamo Indians of the Amazon ingest a hallucinogen before battle. The ancient Scythians smoked hemp, while a neighboring tribe drank something called hauma, which is believed to have induced a frenzy of aggression. So if there is a destructive instinct that impels men to war, it is a weak one, and often requires a great deal of help. In 17th century Europe, the transformation of man into soldier took on a new form, more concerted and disciplined, and far less pleasant than wine. New recruits, and even seasoned veterans, were endlessly drilled, hour after hour, until each man began to feel himself part of a single giant fighting machine. The drill was only partially inspired by the technology of firearms. It's easy enough to teach a man to shoot a gun. The problem is to make him willing to get into situations where guns are being shot, and to remain there long enough to do some shooting of his own. So modern military training aims at a transformation parallel to that achieved by primitives with war drums and paint. In the fanatical routines of boot camp, a man leaves behind his former identity and is reborn as a creature of the military, an automaton, ideally a robotic, willing killer of other men. This is not to suggest that killing is foreign to human nature, or, more narrowly, to the male personality. Men and women have again and again proved themselves capable of killing impulsively and with gusto. But there is a huge difference between a war and an ordinary fight. War not only departs from the normal, it inverts all that is moral and right. In war, one should kill, should steal, should burn cities and farms, should perhaps even rape matrons and little girls. Whether or not such activities are natural or at some level instinctual, most men undertake them only by entering what appears to be an altered state, induced by drugs or lengthy drilling, and denoted by face paint or khakis. The point of such transformative rituals is not only to put men in the mood. Returning warriors may go through equally challenging rituals before they can celebrate victory or re-enter the community, covering their heads in apparent shame, for example, vomiting repeatedly, abstaining from sex. Among the Maori, returning warriors could not participate in the victory celebration until they had gone through a Wakahoa ritual, designed to make them common again. The hearts of slain enemies were roasted, after which offerings were made to the war god too, and the rest was eaten by priests, who shouted spells to remove the blood curse and enable warriors to re-enter their ordinary lives. Among the Taulipang Indians of South America, victorious warriors sat on ants, flogged one another with whips, and passed a cord covered with poisonous ants through their mouth and nose. Such painful and shocking post-war rites impress on the warrior that war is much more than a continuation of policy by other means. In war, men enter an alternative realm of human experience, as far removed from daily life as those things which we call sacred. The religion of war. Not only warriors are privileged to undergo the profound psychological transformation that separates peace from war. Whole societies may be swept up into a kind of altered state, marked by emotional intensity and a fixation on totems representative of the collectivity. Sacred images, implements, or, in our own time, yellow ribbons and flags. The onset of World War I, for example, inspired a veritable frenzy of enthusiasm among non-combatants and potential recruits alike. And it was not an enthusiasm for killing or loot or imperialist expansion, but for something far more uplifting and worthy. In Britain, the public had been overwhelmingly opposed to involvement until the moment war was declared, at which time screaming crowds poured into the streets and surrounded Buckingham Palace for days. In Berlin, the crowds poured out as though a human river had burst its banks and flooded the world. In St. Petersburg, a mob burned the furnishings of the German embassy, while women ripped off their dresses and offered them to soldiers in the middle of a public square. When the United States entered the war, on April 6, 1917, the audience at the New York Metropolitan Opera House stood up and greeted the announcement with loud and long cheers. Hardly anyone managed to maintain their composure in the face of the oncoming hostilities. Rainer Maria Rilke was moved to write a series of poems extolling war. Anatole France offered to enlist at age 70. Isadora Duncan recalled being all flame and fire over the war. Socialists rallied to their various nations' flags, abandoning the international working class overnight. Many feminists, such as England's Isabella Pankhurst, set the struggle for suffrage aside for an equally militant jingoism and contented themselves with organizing women to support the war effort. "The war is so horribly exciting, but I cannot live on it," one British suffragette wrote. "It is like being drunk all day." Even pacifists, like the German novelist Stefan Zweig, felt a temptation to put aside their scruples and join the great awakening of the masses prompted by war. In India, young Gandhi recruited his countrymen to join the British Army. Even Freud, as mentioned above, briefly lost perspective, giving all his libido to Austria-Hungary. But Freud failed to reflect on his own enthusiasm. Otherwise, he would never have hypothesized that men are driven to war by some cruel and murderous instinct. The emotions that overwhelmed Europe in 1914 had little to do with rage or hatred or greed. Rather, they were among the noblest feelings humans are fortunate enough to experience. Feelings of generosity, community, and submergence in a great and worthy cause. There was little difference, in fact, between the fervor that greeted the war and the emotional underpinnings of the socialist movement, which promised land, or bread, and peace. As historian Albert O. Hirschman has written, "For important sectors of the middle and upper classes, the war came as a release from boredom and emptiness, as a promise of the longed-for community that would transcend social class." Just after the war, the American psychologist G.E. Partridge observed that the mood of war had been, above all, and despite the war's acknowledged horrors, one of ecstasy. Drawing on the work of early 20th century German psychologists, he enumerated, in a way that can now only seem quaint, the various ecstasies associated with war. That of heroism, of taking part in great events, or of victory, Siegestrunkenheit, the joy of overcoming the pain of death, and, summing up all the other ecstasies, the social intoxication, the feeling on the part of the individual of being a part of a body, and the sense of being lost in a greater whole. The thrill of being part of a vast crowd, of abandoning ordinary responsibilities in order to run out into the streets, of witnessing such great events as declarations of war. This was ecstasy enough for the millions who would never see actual combat. It was the sense of self-loss, Partridge opined, of merger into some greater whole, which showed that war was an attempt to meet the same psychological needs otherwise fulfilled by love, religion, intoxication, art. A historian of our own time, Roland Stromberg, would agree, writing of the men who volunteered to fight in World War I. Doubtless they found hell, but they did not go seeking it. Rather than an itch to kill, hurt, or torture their fellow men, as Freud claimed, they felt something much more akin to love. The mass feelings inspired by war, many noted right after World War I, are eerily similar to those normally aroused by religion. Arnold J. Toynbee, the British historian, had been caught up in World War I, like most of his peers, and produced several volumes of atrocity propaganda as his contribution to the war effort. Later, repenting for that brief burst of militarism, he argued that war had in fact become a religion, moving in to fill the gap left as the traditional forms of worship lost their power over people. Man, he wrote, requires spiritual sustenance, and if man was now less inclined to find it in a church, he would find it in the secular state and express it as a militant nationalism in which the glorification of war is a fundamental article of faith. To say that war may be, in an emotional sense, a close relative of religion is not to pass moral judgment on either of these ancient institutions. We are dealing with a very basic level of human emotional experience, which can be approached just as well at, say, a labor rally, as at a nationalist gathering or a huge outdoor mass. Coming together in a large crowd, united by some common purpose, people feel a surge of collective strength, and they may project this sense of power onto God, the nation, or the people. El pueblo unido, goes the left-wing chant, jamás será vencido. The people united cannot be defeated. As the 19th century theorist of crowd psychology, Gustave Le Bon, observed, somewhat haughtily, in crowds, the foolish, ignorant, and envious persons are freed from the sense of their insignificance and powerlessness, and are possessed instead by the notion of brutal and temporary, but immense strength. Individually, we are weak, but with God, or through the fatherland, or the working class, we become something larger than ourselves, something indomitable and strong. Even those of us who will never experience battle, or for that matter, God, can know the thrill of being swept along with a huge and purposeful crowd. This is one of humankind's great natural highs, and is, perhaps paradoxically, as likely to be experienced at an anti-war demonstration as at a pro-war rally. But it is a high that can be most reliably experienced in contemplation of an enemy, the Viet Cong, or, for that matter, the military-industrial complex, which both excites our adrenaline and serves to unite us. All minor differences, as, for example, of class, disappear when compared to the vast differences, construed as moral, cultural, and sometimes racial, that supposedly separate us from the Jerrys, the communists, the Arabs, or the Jews. Through the mass rally or the spontaneous gathering in the streets, large numbers of people can experience something analogous to the transformation that makes a man into a warrior. Just as the ancient warrior fasted, took drugs, danced all night, and even became a monster, the crowd, too, leaves mundane things behind and transmutes itself into a new kind of being, larger than the sum of its parts, more powerful than any single individual. Consider the British psychologist Roger E. Money Curl's eyewitness description of a Hitler rally. The people seemed gradually to lose their individuality and become fused into a not very intelligent but immensely powerful monster, which was not quite sane and therefore capable of anything. Moreover, it was an elementary monster with no judgment and few but very violent passions. We heard for 10 minutes about the growth of the Nazi Party and how from small beginnings it had now become an overpowering force. The monster became self-conscious of its size and intoxicated by the belief in its own omnipotence. But there is more to the religion of war than the thrill of the mass rally or of the battle itself. In between wars, there are ample reminders of the collective high induced by the threat or actuality of war. The tribal war chieftain had his collection of skulls or similar trophies to contemplate in times of peace. The ancient emperor had his stele, commemorating victories, his temples to Mars or Minerva. In the modern European world, according to historian George Moss, war cemeteries and monuments serve as the sacred spaces of a new civil religion, lovingly tended and solemnly redecorated year after year. The grave of the unknown soldier is an especially stirring reminder of the moral transcendency of war. In war, the individual may be entirely obliterated for the higher cause, made nameless as well as dead. Yet, even in this abject condition, he, or at least some remnant of the glory associated with his passing, lives on forever, symbolized by a perpetual flame. By the 20th century, war, and the readiness for war, which is so much a part of nationalism, had become the force unifying states and offering individuals a sense of transcendent purpose. Today, even in peacetime, the religious side of war is everywhere manifest. No important state function can go forward without the accompaniment of drum rolls and soldiers at attention. The inauguration of presidents, the coronation of monarchs, the celebration of national holidays. These events require everywhere the presence of the soldier as a ceremonial appurtenance. Where there are no true soldiers, exclusively ceremonial ones may be maintained. Even the Vatican, which, one might imagine, needs no further embellishment with quasi-religious pompery, has its Swiss guard. The word sacrifice summed up the religious passion of war for generations of Europeans and Americans. In the rhetoric of religious militarism, killing the enemy was almost an incidental outcome of war compared to making the supreme sacrifice of one's own life. Dying in war was not a mishap inflicted on the unfortunate, but the point, almost, of the whole undertaking. Happiness, the German poet Theodor Körner declared at the time of the Napoleonic Wars, lies only in sacrificial death. Moss has commented on the extensive co-optation of Christian symbolism and ritual to sanctify the life and death of the soldier in World War I. The war was compared to the Last Supper, the soldier's death to the martyrdom of Christ. In, for example, postcard showing angels hovering over handsome, contented-looking, and apparently unwounded corpses. Not all Europeans at all times have seen war as an occasion for a beautiful, sacrificial death, of course. But the notion is a widespread one, and not only among urban, industrialized cultures. In his groundbreaking study of primitive war, the American anthropologist Harry Turney High offered numerous examples of similar sacrificial fervor among tribal peoples. He reports dryly that on Mangaia, for example, in Polynesia, the high-born noble Teora did not shrink when informed by the war priests that their god demanded his sacrificial death at the enemy's hands. He went against the foe alone, and they obligingly killed him, unaware that his immolation was intended to accomplish their own defeat. Caesar reported that the Aquitanians had an elite society of fighters called solidurii, or bound by duty, who were sworn to share one another's deaths in battle, or else to kill themselves. There were similar no-retreat societies among North American Indian tribes. A Crow could vow his body to the enemy, which meant he was prepared to die in an attack against hopeless odds. Self-sacrifice is perhaps the least rational of all human undertakings. Anthropologists may debate whether it is rational, in a self-serving sense, to fight for land or women, or to avenge some wrong. But there is no straightforward biological calculation that could lead a man to kill himself, like one of the solidurii, or to die, possibly unwed and childless, like the Crow warrior, because he has sworn a vow. The biologically rational explanation for certain kinds of altruism is that it promotes the survival of one's kin, and hence of genes that are similar to one's own. It could be argued that this explanation applies to situations in which men die defending their immediate clan or families. Although the practice of exogamy has guaranteed that even clans and families will be of varied genetic makeup. But it is somewhat more of a stretch from a band or tribe of loosely related individuals to the mass, genetically polyglot armies of both ancient and modern states. At bottom, the reason why fighting can never be a question of interest, the military theorist Martin Van Creveld writes, is, to put it bluntly, that dead men have no interests. A cynic might dismiss the religiosity of war as a mystification of its mundane, ignoble aims, all the rhetoric of sacrifice and glory serving only to delude and perhaps intoxicate otherwise unwilling participants. At some level, the cynic would be right. The results of war, the burned villages, bombed cities, sobbing orphans and captives, are the same whether the war was undertaken in the noble spirit of self-sacrifice or was driven by less worthy motives, like vengeance or greed. Thus, most scholars have no doubt felt themselves justified in sliding the high-flown rhetoric and rituals of war to concentrate on its technology and impact. Of all the volumes on war listed in the bibliography of this book, only a half dozen at most concern themselves directly with the passions that have made war, to so many of its participants, a profoundly religious undertaking. But there are at least two reasons to take seriously the religious dimension of war. First, because it is the religiosity of war above all which makes it so impervious to moral rebuke. For millennia, and long before the Enlightenment or even the teachings of Jesus, people have understood that war inverts all normal morality, that it is, by any sane standard, a criminal undertaking. Buddhism, arising in the 5th century BC, condemned war. And one of the most bluntly reasoned anti-war arguments ever made comes to us from the Chinese philosopher Mo Tse in the 4th century BC. When one man kills another man, it is considered unrighteous, and he is punished by death. Then, by the same sign, when a man kills 10 others, his crime will be 10 times greater, and should be punished by death 10 times. Similarly, if a small crime is considered crime, but a big crime, such as attacking another country, is applauded as a righteous act. Can this be said to be knowing the difference between righteousness and unrighteousness? But war, as Mo Tse must have realized, enlists passions which feel as righteous to those who experience them as any of the arguments against it. The other reason to study the religiosity of war is for what it has to say about us as a species, about human nature, if you will, and the cliched problem of evil. Other creatures, including our near relatives, the chimpanzees, have also been known to kill their own kind with systematic zeal. Certain species of ants even do so on a scale and with a tactical ingenuity, fully deserving of the label war. But of course, no other species exhibits behavior we recognize as religious, and none can be said to bring exalted passions to their acts of intraspecies violence. So, we might well ask of ourselves, what is it about our species that has made us see in war a kind of sacrament? Not all wars, of course, have excited the kind of passion aroused by World War I. But does the fact that humans can, and often do, sacralize the act of killing mean that we are more vicious than any other creature? Or is it the other way around? With our need to sacralize the act of killing, proving that we are, deep down, ultimately moral creatures. Which are we? Beasts, because we make war. Or angels, because we so often seek to make it into something holy. A psychologist might offer one sort of answer, based on the anxieties that seem built into the individual life cycle. But here, I am interested in another kind of answer, drawn from efforts to reconstruct our collective biography as a species, our history, and prehistory. Since the search for prehistoric origins has become distinctly unfashionable among contemporary anthropologists, I should explain, first, that the kind of origin I seek is not a hypothetical event, or just-so, story, like the mythical rebellion in Freud's Totem and Taboo, of the primal horde against its patriarchal leader. Antecedent may be a better word for what we are after here. Hunting is an antecedent of war, almost certainly predating it and providing it with many valuable techniques. Here we seek a similarly long-standing antecedent to the sacralization of war. Second, it should be acknowledged at the outset that to know the origin of something is not, of course, to know why it persists or plays itself out over and over. But in the case of repetitive, seemingly compulsive patterns of behavior, the first step to freedom may be to know how it all got started. Like a psychologist facing an individual patient, we need to uncover the original trauma. We begin, in the next chapter, with the most clear-cut case of sacralized violence that human cultures have to offer: religious rituals of blood sacrifice. Even in times of peace, the religions of many traditional cultures were hardly detached from the business of violence. In fact, their rituals have very often centered on the act of killing, either mimed or literally enacted, of humans or animals. As René Girard emphasized in his classic Violence and the Sacred, violence was, well into the historical era, at the very core of what humans define as sacred. And the first question we will address is why. In the conventional account of human origins, everything about human violence is explained as a result of our species' long prehistoric sojourn as hunters of animals. It is the taste for meat and the willingness to kill for it that supposedly distinguish us from other primates, making us both smart and cruel, sociable and domineering, eager for the kill, and capable of sharing it. We are, in other words, a species of predators, natural-born killers, who carried the habit of fighting over into the era of herding and farming. With the Neolithic Revolution, wild ungulates were replaced as prey by the animals in other people's herds, or the grain stored in other villages' fortresses. And the name for this new form of hunting was war. In this account, the sacralization of war arises only because the old form of hunting, and probably also the sharing of meat, had somehow been construed as sacred for eons before. No doubt much of human nature was indeed laid down during the 2.5 million years or so, when Homo lived in small bands and depended on wild animals and plants for food. But it is my contention that our peculiar and ambivalent relationship to violence is rooted in a primordial experience that we have managed, as a species, to almost entirely repress. And this is the experience, not of hunting, but of being preyed on by animals that were initially far more skillful hunters than ourselves. In particular, the sacralization of war is not the project of a self-confident predator, but that of a creature which has learned only recently not to cower at every sound in the night. Rituals of blood sacrifice both celebrate and terrifyingly reenact the human transition from prey to predator. And so, I will argue, does war. Nowhere is this more obvious than in the case of wars that are undertaken for the stated purpose of initiating young men into the male warrior-predator role, a not uncommon occurrence in traditional cultures. But more important, the anxiety and ultimate thrill of the prey-to-predator transition color the feelings we bring to all wars, and infuse them, at least for some of the participants, some of the time, with feelings powerful and uplifting enough to be experienced as religious. Having made that case, convincingly, I hope, in the first half of this book, Part 2 will consider the sacralization of war in historical times, and its evolution from an elite religion observed by a privileged warrior caste to the mass religion we know today primarily as nationalism. We will see it is in our own thoroughly modern time that the rituals and passions of war most clearly recall the primitive theme of resistance to a non-human threat. 2. Sacred meat. All religions are cruel, all founded on blood, for all rest principally on the idea of sacrifice, that is, on the perpetual immolation of humanity to the insatiable vengeance of divinity. Bakunin. In war, men offer their lives and sometimes make the supreme sacrifice. This rhetorical convention links war and religion in a far more literal way than one might suspect. To the modern ear, sacrifice has a passive, almost bloodless sound. We confuse it with self-denial and renunciation, and associate it with images of pale maidens and marble statuary. But sacrifice first appears in the historical record as a well-defined religious ritual, varying in detail from culture to culture, but almost always featuring, at its climactic moment, an act of public bloodshed, the killing, torture, or mutilation of an animal or a human, followed by the ritual disposal of the blood, and, in most cases, the consumption of the dead. Ritual sacrifice is the most clear-cut instance of violence made sacred. When the victim is non-human, the central act of violence is essentially a familiar and understandable one: the slaughter of animals for food. The fact that the simple act of butchery has so often been sacralized hints at a sinister side to the deities so honored, and is suggestive, as we shall see, of an anxiety far older than either religion or war, and possibly central to both. Few religions today openly practice blood sacrifice. Hinduism and Santeria are among the exceptions. In Hinduism, however, animal sacrifice is practiced within popular and often lower caste goddess cults. The mainstream male deities have long since been weaned from blood to candies, butter, and fruit. The idea is repulsive to most modern Western people, who prefer the slaughter of animals to go on unceremoniously and out of sight in thoroughly secular meatpacking plants. But contemporary historians of religion remind us of what religious practitioners often prefer to ignore or forget: that blood sacrifice is not just a religious ritual. It is the central ritual of the religions of all ancient and traditional civilizations. For thousands of years, the core religious ritual from the highlands of the Andes to the valley of the Ganges was the act of sacrificial killing. The temple that housed the altar, or the raised platform or stone circle that constituted a holy place, was also an abattoir. The Judeo-Christian religions, for example, no longer demand, or for that matter permit, blood sacrifice. But sacrifice, including human sacrifice, remains a central theme of the Jewish and Christian texts. In the Old Testament, the decisive event, and the one that defines the relationship between the Jews and Jehovah, is the aborted sacrifice of Isaac by his father Abraham. In the New Testament, it is the sacrifice of Jesus by his Father, the deity himself. And throughout the first five books of the Old Testament, with obsessive regularity, huge numbers of animals are sacrificed